Empire.
Hello and welcome to my podcast. During the season, I had on ESPN's Nick Wagner, who covers the 49ers. Back then, we discussed how that franchise turned it around and what the Redskins needed to do likewise. Well, it started with massive change, and now here we are. So I brought Nick back on. We talked before the NFC Championship game, and I want to discuss this more in depth. What lessons can we apply from the 49ers situation to the Redskins? The difference Nick Bosa has made, and how that applies, of course, to Chase Young. A stadium in the middle of nowhere with dwindling attendance? Sound familiar? It should, and that's why I wanted to have Nick on. You will learn some lessons here. And then I close with my thoughts, an update on Reuben Foster and what it means. Nick and I discussed Foster, but at the time of the interview, we didn't know about his nerve damage. I also have a few other thoughts, including some influences on Ron Rivera. But first, my interview with ESPN's Nick Wagner. Now I'm joined by ESPN's Nick Wagner, covers the San Francisco 49ers. As of this taping, we don't know yet if they're going to the Super Bowl. So when you're listening to it, you'll already know. This conversation has nothing to do with that. So we're going to move forward anyways. And Nick, you are a return guest, so I'm guessing this is a big-time privilege for you.
Yeah, well, anytime you get the initial invite from John Keim, it's a huge deal. But to get the ask back, it really tugs at the heartstrings. It's been a big year for me in a lot of ways, but I think this one is probably going to set the bar really high for 2020.
Amen, brother. The reason why I wanted to have Nick back on, because Nick and I had this conversation back when the 49ers played the Redskins, and it was about how Nick has covered two teams that have turned their stuff around, the Rams and the 49ers. And at the time, we talked about how they did that. And now here they are, and now the Redskins are kind of doing some of what they did. So when you look back, what was the biggest thing that the 49ers did to put themselves in this spot?
Well, to me, I think the big thing was they had to find some semblance of organizational stability and continuity. And that was the thing that they missed the most. It was they had the Jim Harbaugh era, of course, and with Jim Harbaugh and Trent Baalke together, it was kind of an arranged marriage. We saw how it all played out. We've kind of seen now over the years, much to your chagrin, I'm sure, that Jim Harbaugh kind of seems to wear out in places, and he kind of ran his course in San Francisco. And then when Jim Harbaugh left, they hung on to Trent Baalke, and they tried to continue to do the arranged marriage thing. And it was, we're going to pair Trent Baalke with Jim Tomsula because Tomsula and Baalke have a relationship. Well, Tomsula was in over his head as a head coach, a great position coach, as everyone there in D.C. knows, but that's about it. And then after 1 year, they go to Chip Kelly, and that fails. And I think Jed York finally realized, hey, we need to put people in here who know what they're doing and are also on the same page. And that was the biggest goal of that hiring process when they added Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch, was we need two people who are going to be on the same page. And yes, there can be some creative differences, but at the end of the day, they're going to get along, and they're going to figure out how to make this thing work together. And the way they did it was actually very similar to what you're seeing in D.C. They went with the head coach first. Kyle Shanahan was their guy very early on in that process. They identified him. And even as he was coaching the Falcons at the time, he was interviewing defensive coordinators like during the playoffs. I mean, it was very well known this is what it's going to be. The other thing he was doing was figuring out who he wants to be his general manager. He had an aha moment with John Lynch, and he knew John Lynch from his time in Denver and the time that John Lynch spent with his dad. And so that was really the number one thing, was finding those guys who could run the football side. Jed York could take a step back, let them do their thing, and trust that those guys were going to be on the same page, even if they occasionally had a disagreement, that they were going to move forward and there wasn't going to be any sort of lingering issues there.
You know, it's funny because that's been a big issue here over the years, was not being on that same page. It also seems like when I see Kyle and John Lynch talking, it's always, there is always a reference to the other.
as if they're mm-hmm. always kind of in accord with whatever they're doing. And obviously not everything's going to be 100% unanimous, but they're in sure. accord with, this is how we have to be as a franchise and operate.
Yeah, and I think that even little things that maybe don't seem like a big deal, but actually do matter in terms of the details. Like, for example, during the season, the 49ers want to have they want Kyle Shanahan to be the voice of the team because he's the guy who's coaching the team. He's around the team all the time, all those types of things. And then that allows John Lynch to handle some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, other things that might be going on in the building, whatever it is. And then when the offseason comes around, those roles kind of reverse a little bit. You know, John Lynch becomes the guy who's out front a little bit more, speaking to the media more regularly, and Kyle Shanahan can deal with some of the other backside details, personnel-wise and things like that in the offseason. So they really have this kind of they have a really good chemistry anyway, that they clearly are good friends and they get along well and all of that. But I also think that they came in with an understanding of what everyone's role was going to be. They defined it very clearly early on, and they followed through on that. And I think that it certainly has helped lead to some of the success that they've had just beyond the X's and O's and starting to get some really good players in here as well.
And because you were there too, what was the next biggest step after that? Because just getting that's going to be a big deal. But in terms of, because I'm trying to look at things that, you know, a Redskins fan can say, okay, what's the next step after getting those guys in place? Were there some key veterans that they brought on board? I know Richard Sherman's there, obviously, but what were some of the other steps that they did to kind of change more of that culture and get it where they wanted it and needed it?
Well, the interesting thing is if you're looking at any organization, you say the three most important jobs are what? The head coach, the general manager, and the quarterback, right? And so they didn't have the quarterback, but they had a plan for the quarterback when they got here. And so they actually didn't address it right away. If people remember, you know, Brian Hoyer was the guy that they signed to be the quarterback the first year they were here. And it was really just to be a bridge guy. There was never any intent to have him be the long-term answer. Another name that's going to sound very familiar to everyone there, everyone listening, is Kirk Cousins. That was the initial plan, was they're going to pursue Kirk Cousins after their first year here together. He was going to be a free agent. They were hopeful that they could get him. In the meantime, they added some of those veterans that you're talking about. And it was really more about, you know, getting culture and building the culture than it was about guys coming in and making an instant impact. Pierre Garçon, yet another name that's going to ring out there in D.C., was one of those guys. Kyle Juszczyk, who's been a very good player and easily their best free agent signing from that first group that they brought in, was another one. Just guys like that who could kind of help set the tone, start developing the things that they wanted to develop from a culture standpoint. And then, of course, before they got to the Kirk Cousins opportunity, the Jimmy Garoppolo thing popped up. They saw a chance to take a swing at a quarterback without having to pay, at least in the immediate there, the money that Kirk Cousins was going to get. And they gave up a draft pick, a second-round draft pick to the Patriots to get him. And I think that really kind of changed the whole perspective on things, just in the sense that they knew they were going to have to dedicate a lot of money to a quarterback at some point. They ended up doing it with Garoppolo, of course, after just the 5 starts. But I think they also felt like they didn't necessarily know what they had with Garoppolo, but I think they also believed they had a little bit higher ceiling with him than they might have with Cousins. And when they already got a chance to see what it looked like with him in place, it helped them put the other pieces of the puzzle around him moving forward a little bit different than it would have been if you had just grabbed Cousins as a free agent and then said, okay, now what do we do after this?
The other thing, too, when I'm looking at their roster, and this is where the other comparison to me to the Redskins would be, is their defense. And obviously the Niners are ahead of them defensively because they're just better. But the building blocks seem to be in place.
Yep.
Were they when this group took over? At least partially.
Yeah, no question. I mean, and it's I think it was the old Bill Parcells thing, the most important people on a football field are the quarterback and the people who knock the quarterback down. And that's certainly a philosophy that John and Kyle believe in strongly here. And you saw them double down on that, because Trent Baalke, for all his foibles and faults in his time here, he had a couple of good picks there towards the end, especially DeForest Buckner, who I think was easily probably the best player on the team when Kyle and John arrived, certainly on the defensive side of the ball. And then Eric Armstead, who was a guy who had showed a lot of promise. He was a first-round pick the year before Buckner, but hadn't really had a chance to live up to it because of injuries and some other things that kind of derailed him. But when they got here, the Niners, Kyle and John didn't say, this is enough, this is it. We're going to keep doubling down on this. And so they used a very high draft pick on Solomon Thomas, which hasn't necessarily panned out. He's a serviceable player, but probably not much more than that. But they knew going into this past offseason, the biggest thing they needed was to really supercharge their pass rush, particularly on the edges. They felt really good with the two big guys from Oregon and Buckner and Armstead, but they needed that speed edge rush, and they needed to get to multiply, not just get one guy, but get two. So what'd they do? They traded a second-round pick again. This time it was for Dee Ford. He became their speed rusher off the edge. Then they get Nick Bosa with the number two pick, which a lot of people would say, you know, they kind of lucked into that because that was a team that was 4-12 in 2018. That was better than 4-12, but they lost their quarterback. And so that was a team that probably was 8-8 if Jimmy Garoppolo had stayed healthy in 2018. Instead, they're kind of playing with house money in some sense. And while they would have preferred in some ways that Garoppolo would have got those reps and got those chances to develop, well, they got a nice consolation prize instead because they got Nick Bosa. And so now you have those two edge rushers in Ford and Bosa who just complement each other so well with the speed of Ford and then the technique and the power of Bosa. It's like a muscle car and a Ferrari, as it's been is the analogy that's been drawn inside that locker room. And if you turn on the tape, it shows why. And that was the thing that they doubled down on it. And it's become the backbone of the entire team. Everything they do in a lot of ways spins off of what that defensive line is capable of doing from week to week.
And obviously the parallel with that one is Chase Young's going to be sitting there at number two, almost likely for the Redskins. And when you look back at last year, because, you know, you'd read stories leading up to, we'd talk about this and we have to do our NFL Nation mock draft. I know you had him there, but was there ever talk about, because again, this is going to be the discussion for the Redskins fans in the offseason. Should you take Chase Young or do you, you know, should you trade back? You can get a haul. You can, you know, maybe get a big, big return on that pick and get some, you know, because he needs so much and all that. What were the discussions like with that, with Bosa? Was there a talk about maybe trading that pick? And before you answer, one difference is with two quarterbacks in this draft who could go 1-2, depending on how Tua's health checks out, it may make that more of a possibility than last year. But what do you remember about that discussion last year for the Niners?
Yeah, and it would be a 2020 hindsight to go back and say, I think that if there had been another quarterback there, that maybe they would have considered the move down more. But I think that it really was just a situation where everything fell into their laps just perfectly in some sense, because in most years, Nick Bosa was going to be the number one pick in the draft. And quite frankly, he probably still would have been the number one pick in the draft had it been any other team except the Arizona Cardinals, with Cliff Kingsbury as the head coach, right? Yep. It wasn't just because it was the Cardinals. It was because it was the Cardinals, now coached by Cliff Kingsbury, that are taking Kyler Murray. And so it fell in such a way that it was perfect for them, and Bosa was exactly what they needed. He was that last piece that could kind of put that defense over the top. They believed in him very, very strongly. And they were frankly just kind of holding their breath that he was going to fall to them. I don't know that there's a scenario that they would have traded that pick barring just some absolutely ridiculous offer. And I don't think there was ever really much consideration or many offers that were given to that end that would have made them consider it. So I think the only real consideration they had was, I know they liked Quinnen Williams from Alabama, the defensive tackle, but they obviously felt really good about what they have inside already. I don't really think there was too much of a discussion on whether to take Bosa or not. I think he was their guy, and they knew what they were getting pretty quickly. And again, to bring it home and kind of relate it back to what Redskins fans are thinking about right now is, if you're looking at the draft and you're saying, what are the positions that you need difference makers at the most? Quarterback and the guys who knock quarterbacks down. And it can be very, very difficult to find those guys because a lot of those guys hit in the early rounds. If you look at that 2011 draft, there are so many pass rushers in that draft that turned out really good, but there's also been busts over the years too that go really high. And so if you've got a guy who you feel like is a blue chip prospect and you think he is going to be potentially even a Hall of Fame type of talent, passing on him, particularly at that position, other than quarterback, I think is a dangerous move.
And I would agree with that. To me, it's like if the guy's sitting there, you think he's an elite talent, then you take him because you need elite players to win. And it also points to that. They went out and got Dee Ford. They did have some inside guy, you know, some other guys, Armstead, who have provided a pass rush. Whereas the Redskins have Montez Sweat, they have Ryan Kerrigan, and they have inside guys. But again, they didn't also blink an eye, bat an eye, because they had taken three defensive players out of 4 years and still went after Bosa in that year. And I know some of those weren't their guys, but the point is they did go defensive heavy, and that certainly has seemed to key a lot of that in the run game has keyed their resurgence.
No question. And you know, if you'd ask me in August or July, what's the biggest question facing the 49ers going into the 2019 season, the answer would have been the secondary. I wrote about it many times. I wasn't the only one. But other than Richard Sherman, who was still coming back, you know, he was going to be a year removed from that Achilles injury and played pretty well in 2018, not quite to his normal level. But he was the one guy you felt pretty good about. But they had questions at the two safety spots, certainly at the other corner spot. They felt pretty good about their nickel, but everything came together when they got that pass rush, because it made everybody's life so much more difficult, or so much easier, I should say, on the back end. And there were so many times this year where you would see the pass rush was getting home so quickly, quarterbacks were just firing the ball kind of aimlessly. And the Niners, who last year, this is the craziest stat, people may forget about it, in 2018, they set a league record for futility in takeaways. I think they had 7 takeaways the entire season and only 1 interception. They passed those numbers within like 3 weeks this year, and a lot of it was interceptions, but a lot of that was coming because the pass rush was getting home and was forcing quarterbacks to get rid of the ball quicker than they wanted. So it really is one of those things where everything, you know, you talk about it being a passing league, and some teams maybe now want to spend more resources on their secondary as opposed to the defensive line, but if you really bolster and you supercharge your pass rush to that point, there is a trickle-down effect that is undeniable, and I think the Niners are a prime example of that.
Yeah, and like I said, that's where, like I said, it's going to be a big discussion. It's going to be a discussion, whether it's a big one or not. I mean, I'm all for taking that guy. And the other guy I wanted to ask you about, too, because you've got experience with him, covering him, is Reuben Foster. And haven't seen him play for the Redskins yet, despite he's been here. He will have been here for 18 months or so soon, right? Since November or whatever, from 2018. The Redskins are going to a 43, and I'm curious what, you know, covering him there, where did the Niners feel that he worked best and why?
Yeah, I think initially when they drafted him, having him as the mic backer was kind of the plan. I think after having him around a little bit, you know, at the time they still had Navarro Bowman. And so they were trying to figure out, you know, where does he plug in? What's the best thing to do here? So they plugged him at weak side. And I think that ultimately they felt like that was the position where he could best do the thing he does best, which is, you know, sideline to sideline, run and chase type of linebacker who's not afraid to come up in run support as well. And as that went on, you know, they released Navarro Bowman, and that was Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch's first year together here. They released Navarro Bowman about midway through that season, and then it was, okay, well, now Foster becomes your middle backer, and, you know, he dealt with some injuries and things like that as that year wore on. And in the offseason, they drafted Fred Warner, who's turned into a really, really good middle linebacker, maybe one of the most underrated players in the league. I think people are starting to learn.
He's really good.
Yeah, he's very good, and he does so many things. I call him the onboard computer for their defense. If the D line is the engine, he's the onboard computer, because he's doing everything pre snap, the adjustments. You know, when guys go in motion, he's pointing things out. He does all those things. He's obviously the guy with the green dot who you know gives the plays and all that stuff. But Robert Saleh has pretty much given him carte blanche to do whatever he feels needs to be done if he sees something pre snap and things like that. And quite frankly, those were things that I don't think they believed Reuben Foster could do, at least not things he could do that would also allow him to continue to play at the speed that he would normally play at. And what I mean by that is I think that if he had to do too much thinking, he was one of those guys where it could slow him down, which is not what you want, because that's not he's the kind of player that his speed and ability, his athleticism are things that are certainly weapons for him. But I think ultimately weak side linebacker is probably the spot where he's best served to do the things that he does best. And if you're talking about a guy like Ron Rivera, who's been around for so long and he understands what's the best for his guys, put them in positions to succeed, I would think that's probably what he would end up doing there as well.
Just a couple more here, Nick. How important has Richard Sherman been? And again, I'm looking at this because, like, did they feel like they had to go out and get that one more veteran to come in and be a voice to help on that defense? Because it does seem like there was a lot of young talent. How important was having a veteran, older voice like Sherman for them?
He's been huge, John. And it's funny because, you know, it does get lost sometimes because Sherman is one of those guys who we all know likes to, you know, he motivates himself by throwing fuel on his own fire. And he admits to this, he will invent things in his head that are slights or perceptions of him that may not even be all that real or certainly things that aren't that important, but they're things that keep him motivated. He does that for the team, though, too. And one thing I noticed, I wrote a story about him just before the Vikings game, the first playoff game for the Niners. And the story was basically that Richard Sherman is the straw that stirs the 49ers' drink, and he's the guy who is constantly hyping up his teammates, pumping them up, but also keeping them grounded, which is a fine line to walk. But it's really interesting because you can't sit through a Richard Sherman press conference and without hearing at least the names of about a half dozen of his defensive teammates. And it's him, you know, you got to give credit to Jaquaski Tartt because he did this, that, and the other thing. Or you got to give credit to Fred Warner. He did this that you nobody saw, but it was a huge factor for us. And those are the types of things where he understands his platform because he's a superstar player in this league who's probably going to be a Hall of Famer. He's a very good player still, which, you know, also kind of seems to get lost in the shuffle with all that stuff. But he has brought an element here of being the guy who people rely on when they need something and when they need some guidance. And he told me a funny story. I was talking to him. I don't think he would mind me sharing this. I was just talking to him kind of off to the side a couple weeks ago before their first playoff game. And I asked him, like, do you ever have to, like, you know, slap some of these young guys around and get them in, you know, get them to fall in line? And he said, you know, what's funny is guys will come up to me and they'll say, you know, I was thinking about doing this, like going out to party or doing this last night, you know, the day before practice or whatever. And then I thought of you and I said, I'm not going to do that. And so guys are like actively scared of disappointing Richard Sherman, which I think is, it speaks to kind of the level of trust and, you know, leadership that he's brought to the locker room beyond just being a really good football player.
You know, but that's why I say there's so many parallels that I think the Redskins could use a guy like that. Last thing, Nick, too, what was it like, the culture, when you got there, and when and how long do you think it took to really change it?
I mean, the culture was not good. I mean, they were in a bad place. And look, my first year covering the 49ers was Chip Kelly's year here. That was 2016. And I felt bad for Chip in some sense because – he was just in a no-win. There was very little chance he was going to win here. The roster was depleted. He and Trent Baalke were clearly not on the same page. They were on their third coach in as many years, and so things were really kind of falling apart. And you know, Joe Staley is a good example. He's been kind of one of the bedrocks of this franchise for a long time, and he reached a point where he almost retired after Chip Kelly got fired because he didn't know what the direction of the organization was going to be. And it was pretty bad. When they hired Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch, and you and I talked, and you can vouch for me on this, you and I talked at the time. I think I called you right after we knew it was going to be Kyle, just to kind of pick your brain about, you know, what you knew about him and all that kind of stuff. I got a sense, unlike any sense I had in my 16 years covering the league. And as you know, I've covered some really bad teams. I covered a lot of bad teams with the Rams. I knew instantly that Kyle Shanahan was going to be the kind of guy who, from an X's and O's standpoint, was going to be a massive upgrade over what they'd had previously. But the question was, how is he? What kind of culture is he going to build? And it was evident really quick, John. I mean, really, really quick what he was trying to do. And you know, he and John Lynch made it a point to, let's embrace our history. Let's bring back Jerry Rice and Steve Young and Joe Montana, and open the doors to all the alumni. And you started seeing those guys come around. Within 2 weeks, Steve Young and Jerry Rice were speaking to the team in the first training camp under Shanahan. And then just some of the stuff that they do in terms of, like, keeping things loose, making sure they have fun. Kyle Shanahan, still a young guy. I mean, a lot of those players really relate to him on a number of levels. I mean, Emmanuel Sanders, when he got here in a trade midseason, the first thing he mentioned was, How could you not love Kyle Shanahan? The guy wears Yeezys, you know, like that, like just like stuff like that, that resonates. And it's not fake. It's just too, you know, Kyle Shanahan likes hip hop. Kyle Shanahan likes Yeezys. You know, those are things that players can relate to that help them. But then the key is when they go into the meeting room on an X's and O's level, he's a level above everybody else. And every player in that room knows that if they just do what they're told, he's going to put them in a position to have success. And if you're in a position to have success and then you have it, guess what happens? You get paid and you probably win on top of it. So I think it was very quick, the culture change that Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch brought here. And I think now you're kind of seeing it all come home to roost now that they've been able to improve the roster to the point where they can compete.
Yeah, and just for Redskins fans listening, this is not about Kyle Shanahan leaving the Redskins. They made this mistake. It's about the lessons the Redskins can learn from the 49ers from that what they did out there. Because, Nick, as you might know, there are a lot that stuff gets brought up a lot. And I don't blame Redskins fans don't want to hear that. But it's I've been more curious about how they did things and the things that can be – lessons that can be applied here. And then, just like here, for a couple of years there, people weren't going to those games out there. And, you know, mm-hmm. I remember when we went out there a couple of years ago, like – it was not a full – it wasn't close to a full stadium. It was an iconic franchise that had fallen.
No question. And I think, you know, you and I talked about this when I was out there. Well, I guess that was October, that rainy weekend in October when we did this podcast the previous time. And you and I talked about what are some of the traits that have to be fixed for bad organizations to turn things around or bad teams to turn things around. And one of them was, you know, it always starts at the top, right? It starts at the top down. And I think that a lot of times it takes some introspection from the ownership level, maybe down to the other level. You and I talked about that. I know that the Redskins fans, and rightfully so, were disappointed with the Bruce Allen situation. And yep. Clearly they, you know, at the time it didn't seem like that was going to be something that changed, but at least it did. So maybe it does give you some hope that maybe there's some revised thinking going on at the highest levels, because everything starts at the top. And that's why, you know, owners, Jed York famously said here after he fired Chip Kelly, you know, owners don't get fired. And that's true. But what an owner can do is can take a deep look at himself and try to understand what he's doing that's not working, how he can help put the team in position to succeed. And to credit Jed York in this case, he did that. He realized that he needed a coach and a general manager who are going to be on the same page, who could lead the football operation with an iron fist, but also in a way that gives them an opportunity to get back to the ways they had success. And if that happens, then it can all trickle down and it can turn around. And the funny thing too, John, is I always hear people say about the 49ers that they can't believe this. 1 year turnaround is unbelievable. Keep in mind, this has not been a 1 year turnaround. Right, this has been years in the making, even under Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch. It didn't happen in 1 year. It took until year three, which I think ultimately was probably the year they targeted initially anyway. They got a couple of boosts along the way. Certainly having the number two pick and getting Nick Bosa was one of those things. But it does take a little bit of patience, and I know that can be frustrating. But it also, I think, probably for long-suffering fans, makes it a little sweeter on the other end if you come out on the right side of it.
Yeah, and I think these guys are in a position for it. And I wouldn't say a turnaround where they're in the NFC Championship game, but a turnaround where you can say, you know, is 500 attainable? Well, I think it probably is, because you're only, you know, you're talking, you know, what, four games, you know, just a few games, but, you know, we'll see. So long way to go, but I appreciate you sharing the insight, because I do think there are parallels to this organization, what they're trying to do and what the Niners have done, and their histories as a franchises are comparable. So I think that's why I want to have you on. Nick, thanks a lot. And at this, as of right now, you're either going to be starting when this is airing, you're either starting your off season or getting ready for the Super Bowl. So either way, enjoy.
Yeah, I'll try to do that, and I will look forward to the coveted invite number 3 from the John Kine podcast. I don't know if that sets me up
don't
for a Hall of Fame invite or not, but I'll anxiously await that.
We'll see how the fans react to this one first.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, man.
After this break, I'll be back with my thoughts, including Ron Rivera and Andy Reid, and why that connection matters. And what can the Redskins learn from these Super Bowl teams? Okay, now it's time for my thoughts, so let's get to it. Let's start with Reuben Foster. On Sunday, the NFL Network reported that Foster had sustained nerve damage in his left foot after tearing multiple ligaments in his left knee last spring. As you might recall, he tore his ACL, LCL, and MCL on the first day of OTA work last May. Foster's agent told the NFL Network that he's getting feeling back in his toes, the underside of his foot, and the side of his foot. That left him optimistic about an eventual return for Foster, although there was no timetable on this. His agent told the network that Foster couldn't feel his toes for the last few months. I was asked a few times, of course, on social media about this, and I think the assumption was that many knew about this, and I can tell you they did not. I did not. I don't think any other reporters knew, but that's just my sense and not anything factual. I will say we saw him a handful of times, and Foster didn't seem to have any issues walking, so there was no reason to think that there was some major issue with his foot. And I'm not saying there wasn't, I'm just saying that's why it wasn't really detectable just from our point of view. I did request interviews with him on a handful of occasions. All were obviously denied. There were so many issues going on with the Redskins this season that Reuben Foster's future and his situation was not exactly on the radar. I did talk to someone recently about him. They were optimistic about what they saw from him. They liked the fact that Ryan Anderson was still strongly with him and that he was the key figure to getting Foster, kind of keeping him on the right path. I did ask someone from the team about all this nerve damage. They didn't even know about it. So I don't know how widespread the knowledge was within the building. And I'm sure there were definitely people who knew because there was their jobs to know. But the point is, not everyone there knew the severity of the situation. Also, those who did know, well, there was no way they're going to let that information leak out. You could get in really big trouble because of HIPAA laws. And then I think this is such a sensitive situation that you really have to be careful. The Redskins, I will say, teams are really good at protecting information when they really want to and when there's a united front. It's that united front that always has gotten them in the past. The reason stuff has leaked out in the past is because there wasn't a united front. In this case, there clearly was. It's such a sensitive topic here. And regardless, the Redskins will prepare as if they won't have Foster. That's the only way they can go. Just like last offseason, they had to prepare as if they would never have Alex Smith again. So look for them to pursue someone this offseason to fill that inside linebacker's role, and whether it's through free agency or the draft. And really, I think, well, I'll get to this in a minute on Foster, but one name to watch here is A.J. Klein. He was a backup to Luke Kuechly in Carolina and nearly signed here a couple years ago before joining New Orleans Saints. Technically, he has 1 year left in his deal, but my understanding is that it's more or less a phantom year, so he's going to end up being free. He could always stay with New Orleans. I have no clue if the Redskins are even interested in him. This is my own piecing things together and not anything I'm getting from them by any means. But he could fill what they need. And again, he has a history with Rivera. He doesn't have it with Jack Del Rio, but he does have it with Rivera. I'm not sure where they would have even played Foster, and that's kind of was part of the discussion with Nick that I had. Rivera, my understanding, wants his middle linebackers to call signals and handle those duties. As Nick Wagner mentioned, that's not exactly a strength of Foster's or hasn't been in the past. They want him to play. If you want a guy like that to play fast, you kind of have to make sure that you're putting him in position to do so. Another thought, when Jack Del Rio was the coach of the Raiders, he started rookie fifth-round pick Markell Lee in 2017. The point is, he wasn't afraid to put a rookie in there, so you could see someone maybe coming from out of the draft who could fill those roles. Or maybe they put Cole Holcomb there. I think they're still trying to figure out what they're going to do. Getting back to Foster, I don't know what the future holds for him, but he was always a guy I would be afraid to count on just because of all the multiple things he has going on, whether it's on the field or off. As they say, availability is the best ability, and he just hasn't been available for a multitude of reasons. But at this point, when you're talking about nerve damage, all you really want to do is regain the ability to have a normal life. I look at Kyshawn Jarrett. He still doesn't have that with his right arm from the nerve damage that he suffered at the end of the 2015 season. Jarrett has carved out a good life for himself. I think it's because of his mindset, et cetera, et cetera. and we don't know where this is going to go with Foster. I know there's a long way to go, so we'll have to stay tuned. Number two, Andy Reid. No, he does not coach the Redskins, but he does have an impact on them because of his relationship with Ron Rivera. Rivera was a linebackers coach under Reid from 1999 to 2003 and remains close to him. Considering Reid is in his second act as a head coach and that the two have a strong relationship, it would make a lot of sense if Rivera had reached out to him after being fired from Carolina. Talking to guys like Reid or even Joe Gibbs, among others, will shape how Rivera wants his second coaching stint to go. Any moves he makes will be framed under this advice, from removing the ping pong table to any eventual player moves. The time to do any moves like this is in the beginning. Once you start going down a road, you can't kind of then start taking things away. You take them away early and you let it build up back up. I think that's just a guess that that's how this is going to go. I think it's why Rivera was vocal about what he wanted to see in terms of approach and accountability from all his players. There are definitely some in the locker room who had better adhere or they will be gone. Rivera is intent on changing the culture in there, and that means being accountable, showing up on time for things, etc., etc. Reid had a more successful first run in Philly than Rivera had in Carolina. In fact, Reid only had three losing seasons out of 14 years with the Eagles. Rivera had three winning seasons in eight full-time years with the Panthers. I do think, as I've said a number of times, Rivera is a good coach, and that was a good hire. In fact, those are the only losing seasons that Reid has had. If the Chiefs win the Super Bowl, he should be a Hall of Fame lock. Rivera isn't in that category as of now, but what I like is how it appears that Rivera has talked to many about what he must do to improve or how he can have a successful stint in his second go-round. This matters to him, and I do believe he's a grinder. The Redskins have needed a coach like that for a while. It leads to greater attention to detail, greater urgency, and also, I think, more discipline. I don't know if he's going to succeed, but that approach is the right one, and it's a good start. Seeking information from guys like Reid or Joe Gibbs is very wise. Reid is someone who constantly tries to update himself and seeks information from all over the place. Guys like that succeed. He is a good model for Rivera to emulate. Number three, it's interesting looking at the Super Bowl teams and trying to deduce what wins in the NFL. I kind of get tired of the "you have to run the ball to win" types who only look at stats to back up the notion why you must run all the time. And that's been prevalent all over Twitter the last couple weeks because of the Ravens, because of the Niners, and because of the Titans. And I kind of get tired of the pass-heavy mindset as well. Why? Well, because the Chiefs and 49ers show you one thing. It's about having a plan and an identity and using the talent you do have. The 49ers do not have a dynamic passing game like the Chiefs do, but they have a run game that scares the hell out of teams. They use the stretch zone and cutback runs to kill defenses. There is a threat of the pass, whether by alignment or situation, that helps too. It's always been an excellent run scheme, and it's why you can take backs that others have passed on and make it work. They use a fullback. Their tight end, George Kittle, is a terrific blocker, and their receivers block their butts off. It leads to huge runs. Kyle Shanahan also forces teams to defend the entire width of the field in the run game. That also matters. That's where the unpredictability comes in. That's why I say I don't view them as ultra predictable. Yes, we'll know they're going to run, but it's about the design and when and how it's run. Which way are they going to run? That's where when you talk about balance, it's about how you call your plays. It's not just about are you running or passing. It's about how you're doing both. If you just run the same pass all the time, it doesn't mean you're being balanced. It just means you pass then. I think the same is true in the run game. The Redskins ran the ball last season, but it was predictable. It didn't lead to anything other than better rushing numbers. Again, it's not as simple as saying you have to run more. No, you have to run better. How do you do that? Watch the 49ers. This season, the 49ers averaged an NFL best 6.13 yards per carry on first down runs in the opening half. That's according to ESPN stats and information, and that's unreal. Of course, you stick with that. And I use those numbers because it's not just about running out the clock and compiling stats in the second half because you're winning. It's about the effectiveness early and why you want to stick with something. That's what the 49ers have done, and that's good coaching. Meanwhile, the Chiefs have a lot of talent to skill positions and a quarterback who's fantastic, so they have gone in that direction. Both work. The lesson, make it work with what and who you have. Both of these teams do. Also, both teams have excellent offensive lines. Patrick Mahomes can extend plays, but he can also get to his second and third options while in the pocket before looking to move. The 49ers offensive line opens holes, man. They just open holes. The Redskins are damn close to having a terrific defensive line, and adding Chase Young would make it complete. But they need to get the offensive line right, and a lot of that starts with what they do with Trent Williams, Eric Flowers, and Brendan Scherff. I don't see all three leaving, but I don't have any new information on any of them. I like Wes Martin in case one of the guards leave, and at this point, I don't know if they will. I think they understand if they want to run a power running game, which I think they do, then you're going to want to keep both those guards some way. You can tag Scherff. I don't know how expensive Flowers is going to be. I think that will be something it'll be interesting to see. So they might be able to keep them both. I also think that Martin could end up competing at center with Chase Roullier, or simply being a solid backup for another year or two. And that would be a good thing for the Redskins because they haven't had good interior line depth. That's what makes teams good because, as we've seen, you're always going to need to tap into that depth along the front. The takeaway from both these teams in the Super Bowl is that you need to have a strong foundation, and both do. The Redskins need more weapons on offense, and we'll get into more of that later this offseason, but a quick turnaround relies on them getting it right up front first. It also comes back to this, going with what works for you and not just following whatever is the narrative of the day. There are many ways to win, but it starts with knowing who you are and who you want to be. Finally, and this follows what Nick and I discussed about turnarounds regarding the 49ers, but I saw that Al Galdi from the Team 980 discussed how the last four NFC champions won after basically a turnaround. They all kind of surprise winners. The Falcons went from 4-12 to 6-10 to 8-8, and then the NFC championship. The Eagles went from two straight 7-9 seasons to their title, and the Rams had 10 straight losing seasons, followed by an 11-5 and 13-3 record and an NFC championship. And then here come the 49ers. They won more games this year than the past 3 years combined, which I think is just an amazing stat. It just shows, though, it can be done. It takes more than just change, but in each case, that's what it stemmed from. Quarterback play has a lot to do with it, but it's also about an organizational approach. You wouldn't make this leap to thinking the Redskins can get there next year, but they did take the first step toward it possibly happening. I never once felt in the last 6 years that it would happen without a lot of good fortune. It just wasn't a good organization. Is it right now? We'll see. There's a long way to go here, folks. We're only not even a month into this, but it's in better shape, and that's what needed to take place first. That's it for this week. Thanks to my guy out in San Francisco, Nick Wagner, for coming on, and thank you, as always, for listening. I'm well aware there is no show without listeners. I'll talk to you soon.